give you the proof of something. So remember, we have the complex of curves of a surface. So I wanted to sort of explain the outline of a proof that says the diameter is infinite. Just to give a sort of a feeling for the things that take place. So as I think I said at the end of last time, this proof is due to Low and Kobayashi. So I want to find a sequence of curves in the surface whose distance from a fixed point goes to infinity. Which Kobayashi is it? Certainly not the differential geometry. Not the Kobayashi Noizu Kobayashi. There's a three manifolds guy. So the starting point actually requires a leap of faith. So we begin by saying this: let lambda be a filling geodesic lamination. So I have to tell you what that is, and what does filling mean? So remember, a geodesic lamination on the surface is, let's draw a sort of generic one, is a system of geodesic lines. Let's sort of draw it. So somehow they run through the surface, and they never intersect. All of them are they have no self-intersections or intersections of each other, and they make a closed set. So it's some very thin set of geodesics. So I drew some examples last time. So that's lambda, and filling means... Filling means that for all homotopically non-trivial closed curves, curves gamma, gamma intersect lambda is not empty. So it top in terms of homotopy, it fills up the surface. And in fact, actually, I want a slightly stronger, to make the outline work more smoothly, I want a slightly stronger condition. In fact, we can require the following. There exists a lambda with a slightly stronger property that for every, not just for every simple, for every closed curve, but for every geodesic lamination, mu, if mu has no transversal intersection with lambda, so either mu and lambda intersect transversely, or if they don't, then they're equal. Okay, so that's slightly stronger than this filling condition. Okay, so what you want to imagine here is that somehow every this has various other properties that follow from this. In particular, for example, every leaf is dense, so this is a minimal lamination as well. I guess there's a lot of dynamics people in the audience, so maybe I don't have to work too hard to convince you these exist. So I'll just say the generic laminations have this property. So I didn't say what generic means, and I didn't describe the space of laminations, but somehow you should think that it's easy to make these such laminations in the same way that it's easy to make irrational numbers. Okay, so if you believe me that such a thing exists, then here's a proof that the diameter is infinite. So let's believe me about one more thing. So let say alpha 1, alpha 2, alpha 3, and so on be a sequence of simple closed geodesics. Which converge to lambda. Maybe you have to wonder why that exists. But that's not as, once you believe that such a lambda exists, it's not so hard to believe that this is possible. All you have to do to find such curves is, for example, you could pick a point on lambda and then follow this point on its leaf for a very long time, and because the surface is compact, it'll have to eventually come back very, very close to itself. Let's say the picture looks like this. And once it comes back, wait till the first time that it comes within a millionth of a centimeter of itself, and connect it up like this, and then straighten this, and you'll get a closed curve which is very close to lambda. Okay, so you can make this notion rigorous as well. So you can approximate this thing by simple closed geodesics. And I claim that these go to infinity. So let's say fixed base point, and I claim that the distance between alpha 0 and alpha n goes to infinity. Okay, so here's a proof. So suppose not. Well, so if it doesn't go to infinity, then you can, after taking a subsequence, you can assume it's constant. So for a subsequence of the distance, what I mean by why constant? So I want to think of these distances in the one skeleton of the complex of curves. That's up to a bounded multiple. It's the same as distance in the complex itself. And the advantage of distance in the one skeleton is that it's an integer. So if it doesn't go to infinity, then there's a subsequence which is constant. So so I can just assume that there's some constant finite number. Okay, now we'll get a contradiction. So here's the picture. Here's alpha 0, and then here's the sequence, alpha 1, alpha 2, alpha 3, and in some sense, they're converging to lambda. Okay, they're getting, just as sets of geodesics in the surface, they're getting closer to lambda. But their distance from alpha 0 is a fixed constant n, so I can draw a path from alpha 0 to alpha 1 in the one skeleton of the curve complex with some fixed length n. So here's one such path, and then I can draw one for this one, and so on, right? 1, 2, so here n is 4, and so on. So now let's go to the element before the end of this path. So let's call this one beta 1, this one beta 2, this one beta 3, and so on. So I have a sequence of points, beta n, and now the distance from alpha 0 to beta n is n minus 1. And the distance from beta n to alpha n is 1. So beta n intersect alpha n is empty. Now, again, after extracting a subsequence, you can assume that the beta ends converge to a lamination as well. So after, again, taking a subsequence, beta n will converge to some lamination mu. And if beta n and alpha n never intersect, then surely mu and lambda cannot intersect transversely. So I claim that the transversal intersection locus of mu and lambda is empty. Because if there was a transverse intersection of mu and lambda, then eventually for high n, alpha n will be running through here and beta n will be running through there, and I will have an intersection between alpha n and beta. Here? Well, it's because an edge in the curve complex corresponds to two vertices which are disjoint. That's the definition of an edge. So if I can connect alpha 0 to alpha 1 by a sequence of edges in the curve complex, then the penultimate vertex is disjoint from the last vertex.
A sequence of edges that never
cross. No. So each of these vertices corresponds to a curve in the surface, and two vertices connected by an edge correspond to two disjoint curves. So this is meant to be the shortest path of such, shortest sequence of such curves connecting alpha 0 to alpha 1. If such a thing exists of fixed length n, and I take the one just before the end, that one will be disjoint for that one. Okay, so what happens next?
Alpha n and beta n
are disjoint. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, so this alpha n and beta n are disjoint. And then you take the limit, and mu and lambda, well, they may not be disjoint. Maybe these guys are disjoint but getting closer together. So mu and lambda may not be disjoint, but their transversal intersection is empty. And then, because lambda is filling, in fact, lambda is a slightly stronger condition, that's streamlines as part of the proof, then, in fact, they're equal. Mu equals lambda. So what have I produced? I've produced a sequence of vertices going to the same place, actually. So they're going, instead of going to some separate mu, these guys are actually equal. So I've produced a sequence of curves of distance n minus 1, which converge to mu. Okay, now I proceed by induction. So what I guess it's a question of taste, whether you want to stop the induction at this point or at this point. Yeah. So I think that which measure you like. So if you stop here, you get a bunch of things which converge to lambda, but which are all disjoint from alpha zero. So the conclusion is that alpha zero is disjoint from lambda, and that's a contradiction again to the fact that lambda is so. So, all right, so that gives you maybe a little bit of a feel for what it means to go to infinity in this complex. It means that you have to be getting more and more complicated, but in a strong way. You have to be getting complicated in a way that sort of fills up the surface so there's no room for disjoint stuff. Okay, now I claim that there was this theorem, which I won't talk about the proof of, which says that C is delta hyperbolic. Okay, and if you have a little bit of intuition about hyperbolic space or about, even think about trees if you want, delta hyperbolic spaces have some nice properties. One of the consequences of being delta hyperbolic, it's almost immediate from the definition using the thin triangle condition, is that, so one version of it says that if you have two geodesic paths in such a space, suppose gamma and gamma prime are geodesics, and if their endpoints are, say, some fixed distance apart, say distance 1 apart, if you have a picture like this, then they actually stay a bounded distance apart for their whole time. So then from this information, it follows that gamma is inside a neighborhood of fixed radius. Actually, 2 delta will do. Oh, I think. Maybe. Well, let's be careful. So, and vice versa. So geodesics which begin and end near each other stay near each other for their whole length. And a slightly more sophisticated...
Don't they even come nearer to each other?
Well, this is a coarse... This coarse property involves this constant delta which kind of blurs everything that happens in a local thing. So yeah, in actual hyperbolic space, this distance, of course, gets very, very sort of exponentially small. But we don't have any differential geometry, so... an even stronger property that you have is that quasi-geodesics have a stability property. Well, essentially the same property. So what is a quasi-geodesic? So gamma is, say, from an interval. Let's say J is an interval in R. Into some space is a quasi-geodesic if it distorts distances by in a bounded way. So what we mean is that if you take any two points in J, then the distance, say, between gamma of S and gamma of T, where S and T are in J, and this is distance in X, is bounded above by some constant times S minus T plus another constant, and below in a similar way. This is a coarsification of the Bielefschitz condition. So both additive and multiplicative distortion is allowed. So a path like this is a quasi-geodesic, and quasi-geodesics have the same property. So this also holds for quasi-geodesics. Okay. And this is good for somebody like me who always does everything only up to a constant. So if all you can muster up is something which you know is a quasi-geodesic, this tells you that you have some control anyway. Okay. Note, again, just to sort of point out the difference, in something like the Euclidean plane, this is not at all true. So, for example, in the Euclidean plane, a semicircle is a quasi-geodesic with constant roughly pi, and... It does not at all have this property. Two semicircles don't have to; their middles don't have to be close if the endpoints are close. So, okay. So that's one of the things that's true about delta hyperbolic spaces, and this allows us to think about a well-behaved boundary at infinity for such a space. I just want to say a couple things about that. So, the boundary at infinity of any delta hyperbolic space is basically this: it's the space of all quasi-geodesic rays. up to the relation of sun equivalence relation, where two rays are equivalent if one is in if their Hausdorff distance is finite. So if R is inside a neighborhood, say the A neighborhood of R prime, and vice versa for some R for some A less than infinity. Okay, so you have some space, and you look at all possible rays that go off to infinity, and two rays are equivalent if they stay together. So say this one and this one might be equivalent if they stay a bounded distance apart. Maybe let me not draw this circle for all time. Okay, so that gives you a well-behaved object. For example, isometries of C act as homeomorphisms of this boundary. Okay, so these are like the asymptotic directions at infinity, and it's a theorem now. So this is the theorem of Erika Klarreich, another alumna of Stony Brook, that says that the boundary at infinity of the complex of curves is actually exactly the set of filling laminations. So it's not accidental that this example of something going to infinity exists. That's, in fact, these filling laminations actually parameterize the directions, yes, in fact, directions at infinity. Okay? No, it's a little subtler than that. So I'll say two ways. One is, first of all, yeah, so I didn't say there's a natural topology in this space. And then and this comes with the topology, this equivalence. And the topology here, one way to say it is to look at measured laminations instead of just plain laminations. That gives you, and then this gives you some set of measured laminations, and that has a topology, and then you forget the measures. Take the quotient topology when you forget the measures. On this set, it's not so bad. So another way to say it, so there's a way to say this without talking about the measures, and that is that essentially that I guess lambda n converges to lambda if the Hausdorff limit of lambda, so in the Hausdorff topology, lambda n, in the Hausdorff topology of closed subsets on the surface, a sequence of laminations can only limit to a lamination. So this thing, if it exists, is always a lamination, and so the condition of lambda, that lambda converges to lambda, is equivalent for this set to the condition that any Hausdorff limit, not just doesn't need to exist, but that any Hausdorff limit of a subsequence contains lambda. So the Hausdorff limits can have sort of extra little tiny bits of ghost leaves in them, which are not part of lambda. But that's easy. Is this right?
So I mean, the identification is just basically saying you walk out of a quasi geodesic and you sort of somehow take the limit of the curve you're seeing and you get to
yes.
A lemma that says that convergence.
That converges in a certain sense. Yeah, I think I'm actually being a little bit, I'm lying a little bit about this. I think maybe you need a little bit of an equivalence relation here. Well, I didn't talk about measures, but even if you don't talk about measures, you have to think about this up to forgetting isolated leaves or something. There's some technical thing. So in fact, if you look at the curves on this quasi-geodesic, something like this is happening. The curves are converging in a suitable sense to a lamination. Okay, so that's a theorem, and then let me also do one quick example, which I think I always do this example at some point, so I'll do it this time also. It's also nice to have an explicit example in mind. So if the surface is just the torus, the two torus, then what happens to this discussion? Well, actually, some discussion has to change because this is not a hyperbolic surface, and I kept talking about geodesic laminations, but still one can have the discussion. And in this case, first of all, the vertices of the curve complex are in one-to-one correspondence with the rational numbers union infinity, and so this comes from taking any closed curve alpha gives you a homology class, and the homology class has a slope, so it has a slope p over Q in the homology of the surface, which is Z cross Z, once you choose a basis, you have a slope. So there's some you pick a basis for homology. Any homology class has a slope, and then these slopes uniquely determine the simple closed curves on the torus. And there are no edges, because any two distinct curves on the torus are forced to intersect, so there are no edges. So then the discussion is finished, except, well, we don't really want it to be finished. So we can redefine the complex in this case. It's helpful. So we'll redefine edges. So now we have a new complex. The edges are, say, x, y, where if x and y, the curves, intersect minimally. Well, intersect once. So instead of intersecting zero times, which is not possible on the surface, they intersect one time, which is possible. So for example, these two curves are the two endpoints of an edge. But if I make, I can make something which goes twice or three times, now these are not connected by an edge. This one and this one are not connected by an edge. So once you make this definition, I won't harp on this. I'll leave this as another exercise. You can arrange the rational numbers union infinity on the circle using stereographic projection. So here's infinity and here's zero. Here's one. Here's two. Here's three, and so on. Negative one. And then the edges. It's a fun exercise to figure out what this really means. And what it means is that the edges are the edges in what's called a fairy graph, which is a familiar object to many people. So I'll just draw the picture once. So essentially, I connect infinity to all integers, like this, and then I start connecting. So between any two, I can draw one new one. So here I get half, here I get two-thirds, here I get one-third, and you can keep doing this. So you get a triangulation, of the disk. Sorry. So there's this triangulation of the disk, which is this complex. Okay, and note that it is, in fact, not locally finite, just like before. If you look at this point, the link of this point is z. Right? There's infinitely many edges coming in. But it's a reasonably nice graph. More or less any true statement about this graph is not so hard to prove. and what about the boundary at infinity? So the complex itself is the rational numbers plus these edges, and the boundary at infinity of this complex is exactly the irrational numbers. Okay, any irrational point, you can sort of approach it by a geodesic, in fact, along this graph. Okay, and that corresponds to, in fact, geodesics roughly correspond to continued fraction expansions. Yes. What's the geometric meaning of the irrational numbers is that, so here we had slopes, we had rational slopes. So if you draw the torus this way, you get some rational, each closed curve has some rational slope, and then the irrational numbers correspond to foliations which have irrational slope. Okay? So all this is an analogy with what happens in the hyperbolic plane. But in fact, the same exact setup happens, just to sort of record this, if S is a torus with one boundary component, you get the same picture. And if S is a sphere with four boundary components, this is the genus, this number, and this is the number of boundary components. So these two surfaces, it's not hard to see, actually, give you exactly the same picture. For example, this one is related to the torus by the elliptic involution. If you take there's a double cover from the torus to the four-hole sphere where the fixed points of the involution go to the four punctures, and that gives you an isomorphism between the curve complex for the torus and the curve complex for the four-hole sphere. Okay, so these are only mildly illustrative, because these are in fact the only examples where we can give an explicit picture. In all other examples, I don't know of any very concrete explicit picture, but even though we know things about them. Okay, so so now we know a little more about this complex. So I promised to say something about the mapping class group and how it relates to this. So what do I want to say about the mapping class group? So the mapping class group, well, it's a group. There's lots to say about it. But all I'm really going to talk about is the geometric structure of the mapping class group. In particular, how do you make a group into a geometric space? The usual way is you look at the Cayley graph of the group. Right? You look at the Cayley graph of the group. So this group is finitely generated. That's important. So the Cayley graph is just this graph where you organize the elements of the group. You put a vertex for every element. So here's the identity, and here's some other element. And then you have some generating set A, say A1 through AN, and you put an edge between any two elements that are related by multiplication by a generator on one side. So that gives you some kind of a graph. And then you give every edge length 1, and that's a metric space that the group acts nicely on. And the metric on the group that you get from this is called the word metric. Okay, so that's our geometric space, and there's kind of this yoga that says that for interesting groups, the geometric structure of the space is related to the algebraic structure of the group. And there, so there's the notion of quasi-isometric rigidity, which I won't get into, and there's a sort of large subject which one studies carefully how the geometric properties are related to the algebraic properties. I just want to talk about a couple of examples. So I'll state one theorem, and then we'll see how far we can get into explaining how it relates to everything else we talked about. So associated to this group, there's a number which, for want of a better name, I'll call the algebraic rank. I don't think this is a good name, actually. All my colleagues who actually work with Lie groups would probably shudder at this terminology. But let's call the algebraic rank of a group to be the largest rank R, such that there exists a subgroup of the group, which is an abelian subgroup of rank R. Okay, so look for the biggest abelian subgroup inside G and call that the algebraic rank. And then the geometric rank of a group G, once we've made it into a geometric space, is the largest R such that there exists a map from ZR into G, which is a quasi-isometric embedding. So what is a quasi-isometric embedding? It's just like this definition of a quasi-geodesic. So a quasi-geodesic is a quasi-isometric embedding of an interval into a space. And if you look at this exact condition, with this is distance in the target and this is distance in the domain, if you have a map which satisfies this estimate, relates here distance in the domain is just distance in an interval, but if you replace J with any space, then you have this notion of being a quasi-isometric embedding. Okay, so a priori there are many different ways of getting quasi-isometric embeddings, possibly of something into G. This is not required to be a homomorphism. Not required to have any algebraic structure.
So G is a group here, or G is a
G is I'm fuzzing over the distinction between the two. So here it's the group, and here it's the Cayley graph. Okay. Okay, so there's no algebraic structure here. There's just geometric structure. And here, on the other hand, there's algebraic structure, but I don't know that this inclusion is a quasi-isometric embedding of ZR into G. In fact, it's not every ZR inside a group G is quasi-isometrically embedded. Okay, so that's another issue. So So the question of whether these two things are the same is sort of a baby version of a quasi-isometric rigidity property. So this was a conjecture well, so now it's a theorem, but this conjecture was due to Jeff Brock and Vincent Farb. And now it's a theorem, which is due. There are actually two proofs of this theorem. One is due to Ursula Hanenstadt, and the other is due to Jason Bierstock and myself. And it states that these things are equal. So the algebraic rank equals the geometric rank. The math class group. And so this gives you some feeling, maybe, for what the geometry of this group looks like. Okay? And I want to be able to, I want to try to say something about this proof. I don't know if I'll manage to say very much. But so in order to get started, one needs to have some feeling for what the geometry of the group is at all. Right? How do you estimate distances in the group? What do you do? So I want to spend a couple of minutes making some definitions and relating the group geometry to this complex that we already have. Okay, so let's set up a few things. So I have to talk about one more combinatorial object, which is a marking. Markings of the surface. So there are probably 100 different ways of doing this, but this is one particular one. So I want some kind of combinatorial object on the surface which ties down all the topological data that I want to tie down. So it'll be the following. So a marking, mu, is sort of the union of two things. It's a Pant's decomposition, which I'll call the base of mu, and it's a collection of transversals. So it's the following picture. So I'll do this for some particular picture. So here's the base is a Pant's decomposition. So here's a Pant's decomposition. Is that enough? No. So okay, this is a collection of curves which cuts up the surface into pairs of Pants. And then I want to add a little bit more information. Essentially, I want to somehow, just like for the Teichner space, we needed to write down length, in order to pin down a metric, we needed to write down lengths for a Pant's decomposition plus twist parameters, gluing parameters for the curves. I want to do something correspondingly, sort of in the combinatorial setting. So what I'll do is I'll put an extra transversal curve for each green curve. So I'll add here, for example, for this green curve, I'll put in, let's see, how do I want to do this? I want a curve which meets the green curve in some minimal way, and doesn't meet any of the other green curves. So where's the easiest place to draw this? Here I can draw it pretty easily. So here's a transversal to this green curve, which misses the other ones. Here's one for this green curve. So you can do this everywhere. For this green curve, I have to do it this way. It's a little messier. Okay, and I can continue the picture over here. But for every green curve, there's a red curve. And the red curves, so the green curves, maybe we'll call them U1 through UXC. And the red curves are T1 through TXC. And TI intersect UJ is empty for I different from J. And TI intersect UI is either one or two points, depending on exactly the configuration. So you try to make this picture as simple as possible, and that's a marking. Okay. So what? You have one transversal for every green, for every Pant's curve. So the number xi is. I'm sorry. So if you fix the green curves and you ask how many different transversals there are, essentially the transversals to a given curve are indexed by z. You can choose the only real choice. So the local picture always looks like this. There's only twisting. So essentially, there's a picture that looks like this. If you draw a green curve like this, then the associated transversals can. The only thing they can do is they come around like this and like that, and then there's a choice of how to connect them up. So maybe there's some twisting you can do. Okay. So there's sort of a z's worth of choices for the transversals. Okay? Okay. So what's the point of this definition? Well, the point is that this gives you a model for the mapping class group, so which is convenient for what I want to do. It's not particularly convenient for doing algebra, but it's convenient for doing geometry. So so I need one more thing, which is so I want a space of markings, and then I want transitions between nearby markings. So I want to talk about an elementary move between markings. So there's two kinds of elementary moves. There's a twist move. And what that does is it fixes everything except for one particular TI. So you take TI and you replace it with, you apply to it a twist around UI to TI. Again, and all else constants. Okay, so you take this picture, you take one of these red guys, and you give it one more twist in one direction or the other around the green curve. And that gives you a new marking. And then the other move is called a flip. And here I have to cheat a little bit. So essentially, what a flip does is it takes UI and TI and reverses their roles. So essentially, you paint the red curve green and the green curve red. And if you look at this carefully, you'll see that I'm cheating, because if I did that here, if I painted the red curve green and the green curve red, then, well, I would still get, the green curves would still make a Pansky decomposition, but this jointness condition would get a little bit messed up, because the red curve hits other red curves, and if I turn the red curve into a green curve and the green curve into a red curve, then this green curve, then suddenly the green curve hits some red curves it's not supposed to. So you have to do a little bit of fixing. So you have to do, you sort of have to clean up the rest. But there's kind of a well-defined way of doing that, so you can already tell this is not good for algebra, right? So I have to do that. But what is true about this, this gives some kind of a graph. So M is the graph of all markings where these are edges. Marking where elementary moves are edges. And it's easy to prove the following things. It's easy to prove that it's connected, and that the mapping class group acts on this properly, well, certainly by simplicial automorphisms, by graph automorphisms, but properly in the sense that the stabilizer of any point or edge is going to be finite. Okay? So finite stabilizers and has a finite quotient or compact quotient. Okay, that's the purpose of defining these the way I do. I sort of tie down enough that I can't really fix this by more than some finite number of homeomorphisms. So what that says is that the set of this graph of markings is quasi-isometric to the mapping class group. So this implies that the mapping class group and the graph of markings are quasi-isometric. So for the purpose of trying to figure out what the quasi-symmetrically embedded things are inside the group, I might as well do it inside this marking graph, so this is a convenient thing. Oof. Do I have till 3 or till 7? I'll try not to do too much. Okay, so this is some object. Now, what is the relation of this object to the curve complex? So it's not such a complicated relation. You see that the base of a marking, if you forget from here about the transversal, the base of a marking is a maximal simplex in the complex of curves. So just this part, the set of all bases of marking, the set of all Pansky decompositions, that's like a dual graph to the complex of curves. And then we've decorated by extra data, which gives us this locally finite property. And now my goal is to sort of describe at least something about the geometry of this thing. So notice, for example, so here's what we have to do next. So if you have two different markings, you can build two markings which are very, very far apart in terms of elementary moves and markings, but are very close in the complex of curves. For example, I could take two markings that share a base curve and then have some kind of huge complicated difference between them in the complement of the base curve. Take this picture and then just keep this curve and make some extremely complicated change over here. You'll get a different marking which, if you just look at the bases in the curve complex, they're distance one apart or something because they share a vertex. But they're very far apart in the method class group or in the marking graph. So in order to get control of this, what I need to look at, subsurfaces. So I need to talk about subsurface projections. So I'll tell you what that is. So I want to describe a little bit more structure for curve complexes that allows us to get some information about the markings. So suppose that W in S is an essential subsurface. So here's a thing you can do. Okay, suppose that gamma is a curve, and suppose that the intersection of gamma with W is not empty. By intersection, I always mean essential intersection, intersection that can't be homotoped away. So then I can produce inside W something related to gamma. So here's the picture I have in mind. So here's W, and here's the rest of the surface, and then here's gamma. So here's gamma. So gamma is running around. Okay. So gamma maybe is a million miles long, and it hits W in 10,000 separate arcs. But all these arcs are disjoint. And so because they're disjoint, they actually fall into a finite, bounded number of parallel classes. And I can, if I just pick one of these arcs, I get some essential arc. I want to generate something in W, a closed curve in W. So pick any of these arcs of intersection. Whoops, this goes all over here, I guess. And then do a surgery on it to get a closed curve. So just on one side or the other, do this. Here's a simple closed curve. Okay? So this simple closed curve I will call pi W of gamma. That's the projection of gamma into W. Now, I had a choice. There were 10,000 different arcs I could have chosen. But most of the choices yield the same exact thing, because if I take two parallel arcs and I do this, I just get the same curve. And if I ever... and if I make two really different choices, for example, suppose that somewhere in this picture I had this arc. Say, well, I'm not drawing this very well. So here's an arc that I might have in this picture. Suppose I did it with that arc, purple. Well, because the arcs are all disjoint, the curves that I get intersect only once or possibly twice. I think there's a couple of different cases. So any two different choices that I might get here intersect at most twice, and so their distance in the curve complex of W is bounded. So what I claim I get here, I get a map pi W from the complex of curves of S into, let's be a little careful, into the complex of curves of W. Well, if they don't intersect W at all, then I get nothing. So let's add the empty set as a possible value for this map. Okay? So if the, okay, is this clear here? If the intersection is empty, then pi W gives the empty set. Otherwise, it gives some curve like this. And this is well-defined up to bounded ambiguity. So it's defined up to bounded ambiguity. And furthermore, it has this kind of almost Lipschitz property. It says that if x and y have distance 1, say, in the curve complex, and they both have non-empty images, and so in pi wx is different from the empty set, and so is pi wy, the same sort of picture tells you that The distance in the curve complex of W between their images is bounded by some fixed constant. So when I put a constant here, I mean that it's some a priori constant. So I have an almost well-defined map, which is kind of almost Lipschitz, sort of. That's the mathematical statement. So, well, let's see. So maybe I have a chance to sort of maybe state two more facts about this. So lemma one, lemma, this is again work with Maser. This is in some sense the fundamental tool that allows us to sort of take the next step and understand this inductive structure of subsurfaces inside S. It says the following thing. It says, suppose that, what do we call it? Let's call it gamma. Think of it as a sequence of vertices in the curve complex. But I want this to be the vertices of a geodesic in C1 of S. Okay? So imagine that there's a geodesic somewhere in the one skeleton of the curve complex, and these are the vertices I'm listing. And suppose that W is some subsurface, and pi W of gamma I is always non-empty. So that just means that all of these vertices intersect our surface. Okay? It follows that the diameter in W, in the curve complex of W, let's write it carefully, of the projection to W of gamma is bounded. It's bounded by some constant which just depends on the surface. So some universal constant. So what does this lemma mean? This is like, so instead of proving this lemma, let me explain the intuition behind a statement like this. So how should you think of this projection? So let's replace the curve complex by just some nice metric space, and let's make this metric space have whatever nice properties you want. For example, you can think of it as the Euclidean plane, okay, or hyperbolic plane, or some simplicial complex with nice properties. And then if you take a point in here, it has a visual sphere around this point, the sphere of directions around this point. I want this to be analogous to the curve complex of the subsurface. So what's going on here is the point X is analogous to the point which is the boundary of W, this point. The curve complex of W is analogous to the sphere of directions. And then for any point except X in this space, you could take the geodesic from X to Y, and that gives you a projection from Y to the sphere of directions in X. And if the space is some... if the space is a space for which this is true, then it's true that this is a well-defined thing. So, for example, in the plane, this makes sense. So this is the visual projection. This is what X sees. Okay, everything has a direction that it comes from. Now, if you take any geodesic in our space X that doesn't touch X, and you ask, what do all the directions look like from this geodesic? So here's a geodesic gamma, and gamma intersects X is empty. So doesn't come too near X, then the visual image of gamma in X has diameter at most pi. Okay? The visual diameter of gamma is less than pi. Less than equal to pi. Okay? So that's true in various settings that you can imagine. So this is the same kind of theorem, except that the condition of gamma not touching X corresponds to the condition of every curve in gamma having non-trivial intersection with the surface W, and the condition of diameter more bounded by pi is becomes some uniform bound in the diameter. Okay.
But what does this complex similar to the visual sphere? So like it's the right analogy.
Well, sort of because this lemma holds.
but inside of the proof of the dilemma you can make it.
Well, so first of all, this complex, I mean, in some sense, it is like this visual sphere because this complex is part of the link of the vertex. So if you suppose that, let's take the example where the boundary of W is a single vertex, okay? So here's the boundary of W in the complex of curves. Everybody that's in the curve complex of W is disjoint from the boundary, so it all sits. So the entire curve complex of W sits as part of the one neighborhood, the boundary of the one neighborhood of this. So it really is part of the visual sphere in that sense, and that's kind of, that's why the analogy is relevant. And that's more or less the reason. Okay? Okay, let's see, what can I really say about this? You know, maybe I'll postpone uses of this lemma to next time, and so I really don't have enough time to say much more. Let me say one more thing about why this lemma is true, again, to sort of make you feel like, I mean, this of course is not an explanation, but an analogy, but here's a kind of explanation. So, sort of why the lemma is true. Well, so imagine, instead of a finite segment, I didn't say whether the geodesic was finite or infinite. So let's imagine it's infinite. Suppose that gamma is a ray. So think of a ray. Okay? Gamma 1, gamma 2, gamma 3, and it never ends. Okay. Then, by Clairaut's theorem, the gamma ends converge to some lamination lambda. So what we see in the surface, here's W. So this lamination lambda, we'll paint it green. So lambda is a filling lamination. So every leaf of lambda sort of runs infinitely many times around this picture. Right? Okay. I only have a few minutes, so I can't draw infinitely many. So here's lambda. But the neat thing about this picture is that even though lambda, each leaf has infinite intersection number with this curve, pi w of lambda still makes sense. Because it's still true that all these intersections, all these arcs of intersection, fall into a finite number of parallel classes, parallelism classes. And so I can still do the same little surgery trick that I did before. And the closed curves gamma n, after a while, start to follow the leaves of lambda around. So if I wait long enough in this sequence, gamma n will start to do this, right? It'll start to run around the green arcs closely enough that, in fact, the construction on gamma n and the construction on lambda yields essentially the same thing. It's possible maybe they're different by distance 1 or something. So what happens is that eventually, pi w of gamma n is, it comes, say, its distance in the curve complex of W from pi W of lambda is 1 or something, less than or equal to 1. So what that implies is that the diameter in W of gamma is finite. That's all this really implies. This is actually a reasonably good proof of the fact that if you have an infinite ray, its projection to W is finite. Okay? Has finite diameter. So the only difference between this and the lemma is that in the lemma, there's a uniform bound here which works for all rays and all segments. Okay? So to get uniform bounds is the only thing that's left. And then what you have to do is you have to work harder. You have to turn this into a quantitative discussion, okay? Of how long does it take for gamma n to look like lambda enough that we get an estimate, okay? I don't think you can do it with a soft argument because there's not enough compactness in the story. I mean, for example, the set of filling laminations is not a compact space, so things won't necessarily converge if you do that. Okay, so let's see. So we have to bring all this together. I'm not going to do it today. But you know what? Let me at least say, I'll write down a statement which is supposed to be the connection between these things, and then next time I'll say a few more things about what one does with it. So the outcome of all this is that you can use constructions in the complex of curves to build elementary moves of markings. And so here's a theorem, again with Howie. So if I have two points, mu and nu, in the marking graph, okay, two markings, then the distance in the marking graph between these two points is estimated, again, this estimate is in the sense of quasi-asymmetric type of estimates, by a certain sum. So let's write the sum for a second. So I write the sum over all subsurfaces of F. And essentially what I want to write here is I want to write the distance in W between mu and nu. So that's not quite right. I need to do the following thing. So there exists a K. So this is true. Now I have to. So in the last negative minute, I'll explain what this means. So what is it? What do I mean by this? Well, it's just like before. Before I did it for curves and for laminations. I intersected them with W, and I produced some distance. I did some surgery, and I got something in the complex of curves, and I took a distance. This is the same thing, except I can do it with markings just as well as I could do with any of the other stuff. So this sort of makes sense. This is the same construction as before. And then I'm adding it up over all subsurfaces in F, except, well, that's an infinite sum, but then I do one more thing, which is this. I don't have time to explain why this is the right thing, but this notation stands for the following thing. So if you have any number x, then this bracket notation means that if x is sufficiently large, then this just gives x. I should write the other way, sorry. This is just x when x is sufficiently large, and it's 0 otherwise. Okay? So what this does is you look at all these numbers, you throw away the ones below a certain threshold, and you add up all the rest. And that gives you an estimate for the distance between the markings. Okay? And the reason that this is true is that you can inductively build efficient elementary move sequences between markings by just sort of observing which subsurfaces play an important role in this discussion. Well, so maybe I'll have to say something about how this is done. This is kind of a semi-explicit distance formula because, after all, it's some sum over infinitely many things. It's not so clear how to compute any one of them. But it turns out that it does have enough sort of substance in it that you can use it to prove things. So even though it's not exactly a computational formula. So maybe I'll stop here, and tomorrow I'll say a little bit more about what one does.